Thank you very much, and welcome to another bout of competitive wordplay between our, well, not all that competitive word players, Dilys Powell, Frank Muir, Antonia Fraser, and Dennis Norden. And we start, as always, with a short expedition with gun and camera through the dictionary. Frank, what is the meaning of cicatrice? C-I-C-A-T-R-I-C-E.
It sounds like one of those ladies clad in floral clothes who snipping roses with cicatrices. But it isn't, is it?
No, but it's...
It isn't, is it?
I think we'll give you a half mark for that. I mean, it's
it also sounds like one of those French grasshoppers. But I think, in fact, I'm pretty certain it's a scar.
It is indeed.
And it's your territory, isn't it? So tell us all about scars.
Well, not my exclusive territory. It's a heel scar, which... but anyway, you've got your two marks for a heel scar. Not only in flesh, but also on tree trunks, I'm told. Antonia, the meaning of nostrum.
Oh, well, if I... prescribed a remedy to you as a doctor, me not a doctor, that would be a nostrum, wouldn't it? It should really be a meum, but it would be it's a form of kind of quack remedy.
Mm. Yes. That, I was wondering what quality the medicine you had, you were going to prescribe had. It's a quack. Interestingly, the definition of it originally was that somebody who prescribes a medicine that they themselves produce.
Well, that's why you stopped me before I told you what this medicine was going to be.
I only stopped you because I was going to give you two marks.
Thank you very much.
Yes, my father used to write on bottles of whiskey, Pater Nostrum, or Pater's Nostrum. Dilys, the meaning of hippogriff, H-I-P-P-O-G-R-I-F-F, all one word. Hippogriff.
It's some sort of a mythical creature.
It is some sort of a mythical creature.
Hippo. It's partly a horse.
Mm.
And partly another mythical creature, which is a griffin.
And that is partly four marks, which is two marks. Did you want to tell us more about it?
No. A griffin is partly an eagle or something, and partly some... I mean, there are too many animals.
An eagle is partly a bird.
Let's drop it. I can't think of any more animals.
Yes, let's drop it. We'll take your marks and be content. Well done.
How orthodox all those mythical creatures were, weren't they? You know, like a centaur was always kind of a man, and he had a horse where his trousers were, but it was never... It was never the other way round, was it? They never had a horse on top and a man underneath.
Except in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Except in Midsummer Night's Dream.
The bottom was on top.
Dennis, the meaning of palpebrate, P-A-L-P-E-B-R-A-T-E.
How many years do you think I could go... And sort of weasel my way that I don't know this. I mean, would it be called a palpa? This is vaguely medical, I can tell from the instruction.
It is, yes.
Yeah. I know that you medical men palpate things, which is, you kind of squeeze them. So you palp... It's kind of mixed between squeeze and celebrate. So you could have... it would be like an accordion player's birthday or something.
I think that's worth a mark. I think it's a difficult one. Let me give you one clue before we move on, and that is if I were to tip you the palpebrate, you'd know the answer.
There's a lady there. thinks
Who's
it
what
means
she's doing
wink.
At you.
Yes. Does it mean wink?
It does mean wink. 2 marks to Dennis. It also is an adjective meaning to do with the eyelids. But you got your marks. Now, before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. Frank's is, "My word is my bond," which is an old English saying. And Dennis, "An American in Paris," music by Gershwin, and a title of a Gene Kelly film. Meanwhile, let us move on to a collection of words and phrases that have something in common. Frank, what do these words have in common? A tacit, T-A-S-S-E-T, a vambrace, V-A-M-B-R-A-C-E, a pauldron, P-A-U-L-D-R-O-N, and a plastron, P-L-A-S-T-R-O-N. Tacit, vambrace, pauldron, and plastron. What do they have in common?
They're the middle names of the Amadeus String Quartet. you're not registering approval there.
I'm registering enormous approval, because the real meaning is so dull compared to
cauldron,
that.
They're the ingredients of an Armenian pizza. Yes.
Yes. I'll give you 2 marks for 2 very inventive answers. If you can get a bonus now, if you can get the real one.
I don't want a bonus, Mark.
Well, I'll give you the real one.
Oblivion, I don't know.
They're all bits and pieces of a suit of armour. A vambrace goes over the forearm, pauldron over the shoulder, plastron is the breastplate, and the tassets go over the naughty bits. All pieces of a suit of armour. Antonio, what do these have in common, these phrases? A boar's head, B-O-A-R... The other variety doesn't find house room on this programme. A fleur-de-lis, a fox's mask, and a lazy footman. And they're not all flowers in Dillis's garden.
Are they pub signs, or...?
Not a bad idea. They aren't, but that...
You know, they could that, be, couldn't they?
Worth
I could
a
defend
mark.
It.
That's worth a mark.
Yes. Mm.
Are they tattoo patterns that you can get of various parts of your plastron?
They are patterns. They're the sort of thing... I don't suppose Jeeves might have known about them. Jeeves probably would have done, but a Jeeves-like person would know about them.
Napkins or cravats?
They are ways of, believe it or not, of folding napkins.
Yes.
So 2 marks to Antonio.
I only know 2, like sandwiches. They're square or triangular.
Or crumpled up in our household. Or crumpled or uncrumpled.
The lily.
Or recycled. Yeah.
My mother does the lily.
The very important thing is clean side out.
Yes. That's lazy footman.
Dillis, what do these people have in common? Sir Guy the Crusader, Thomas Winterbottom Hans, and the Bishop of Rumpty Foo.
Ah. Well, the Bishop of Rumpty Foo comes in the Bare Bellas. That's the only one I've ever heard of.
Where do you think
the others must be.
Well done. 2 marks to do it. All titles of ballads in W.S. Gilbert's Bad Ballads. Dennis, what do the following phrases have in common? A lamb to the slaughter, a still small voice, faint yet pursuing, and the little foxes.
Are they all titles taken from the same source?
They are.
They're all titles of
well,
books
I'm not
or
sure
plays.
Whether...
Lamb to the Slaughter is a thriller. Mm. Little Foxes is a Lillian Hellman play.
Faint Yet Pursuing
would be a wonderful title for an autobiography.
It's a very rich source of titles, and that's the source we're after.
Well, Antonio thinks it's Psalms or...
It's, yes, bigger canvas than that. Even
the Old Testament.
It's the Song of Solomon.
The Bible will do.
Oh, the Bible, yeah.
We'll give you 2 marks for the Bible. Well done. now around that our word setter Peter Moore rather chirpily calls this and that. Can you quote the lines of poetry that contain the following oft-recited phrases?
Frank, the iron bars a cage.
No. They all are something and something, hence the very clever this and that, you see. The this and that for you are change and decay.
In all around and decay, oh, thou who changest not, abide with me. Lovely hymn.
The author, do you happen to know the author?
No.
Anybody know the author?
Light.
Yes. Yes. No. Lead kindly, H.F. Light, 1793 to 1847. Antonia, you're this and that. Needle and thread.
Needle.
An oft-recited verse it comes from. Needle and thread. A woman sat in unwomanly rags.
It's not the Lady of Shalott. No. Do you mind if I run through a few people?
No.
It's
not. No.
Stanzas.
Yes.
It's a song. It's a song of... The song of a garment.
Oh, to do with a shirt?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Author? As we've had given you a bit of help.
Thomas Hood.
Thomas Hood. Had a ship named after him, I always thought, as a boy. Between them, they've got two marks.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thomas Hood's song of the shirt... With fingers weary and worn, with eyelids heavy and red, a woman sat in unwomanly rags, plying her needle and thread. It says playing her needle and thread here. Dillis, your this and that is scepter and crown.
Ah. Scepter and crown. And that comes in the Golden Treasury.
Well, I'm sure it
does. About page three. Scepter and crown... will tumble down.
Must tumble down.
And something rather take their place with the humble something and something spade, mm-hmm. rhyming with something.
You are the best golden treasurer that I know. I mean, you've dug it out nearly. Do you know, can you remember? I mean, you've got your two marks. The author, do you happen to know?
Sounds a bit like
standing
Kipling's
above it in the Golden Treasury, it says Shirley.
That's right, James Shirley. Two marks. Scepter and crown must tumble down and in the dust be equal made with the poor crooked scythe and spade from the contention of Ajax and Ulysses. Dennis, back to the classroom and let your mind roll. Purple and gold.
Oh, yes. Yes, this is the most action-packed technicolour opening of any poem. The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold. His cohorts were gleaming with purple and gold.
Two marks.
It's by Byron. The title is something about a lovely name, Sennacherib.
That's
but
right.
It is to do with him in some
Well, the destruction, of,
destruction
Sennacherib.
Of Sennacherib.
Well, we all love that at school.
Yes. It's got the rhythm and it's got the colour and
it's got
moves.
Got the right emotions for 12-year-olds as well.
It's anyway, interesting the word cohorts there, which is now misused like mad as colleagues. But now there sounds like pieces of armour, doesn't it? Yeah.
Antonia's uncle, a distinguished physician who taught me, one day on a round at St. Thomas's Hospital, asked a student, what are the causes of an enlarged spleen? And the student, stuttering, said, the causes are legion, sir. To which our uncle said, just give us a cohort or two. Now, let us move on to Frank and Dennis's quotation. Let's see how you get on, Frank, with My Word is My Bond.
Well, recently, a week or so ago, I had the six-monthly letter from my literary agent with a cheque for the royalties on my books for that period. And when I say it's a cheque, it was a stamp, actually, but... A very useful postage stamp, because you know when you get a little parcel and it's 18 and a half p, you know. So, and he also added a letter with it saying that, why don't I go for something a little more commercial? Instead of writing about social history and writing children's books, why don't I, like Ian Fleming, create a super spy, like 007, a sort of mastermind detective who will solve everything? And I thought, well, if Ian Fleming can do it, I can. So I devised this chap, James Bind. James Bind is a major, of course, not a commander. He's a major. He's a major in the army, the Salvation Army. And on Sunday mornings, he plays in front of Staines Town Hall with the little silver band group, and he plays the tuba. And but he's also, of course, a spy, and he's got an OO number, and he's licensed to commit murder, pillage, arson, and to do hang gliding. So when he's not playing on his tuba, he's Agent OOMPAH. Now, he is told by his superior, Emma, who's a lieutenant colonel in the Salvation Army, a lady, Emma, that the world is going to be sold to another planet by the arch-villain Goldthumb. I've created Goldthumb as a more sinister figure than Ian Fleming's. He's like a shorter, fatter Goldfinger. And what OOMPAH has got to do is stop this selling the world. So he grabs his tuba at the end of playing in Staines Market Square, and he's just crossing Staines Bridge when a car draws up. Two men jump out, take his tuba, ram it over his head. He blacks out, and he awakens, and he's in a 5-foot cylinder welded tight. He's underwater. He can hear the waves. He's bound and gagged, and 2 foot away, well out of his reach, is a time bomb with 30 seconds to go, ticking away. "Ah," says James Bind, "I must get out of this." So what he did was, and that's as far as I got. I couldn't think of any way he could possibly get out of a welded cylinder underwater with a time bomb about to go off. I thought, well, change your tack, Frank. So then I changed my total approach and thought of this Belgian detective, Hercule Le Bon, who thinks with the little grey cells. And I thought of this wonderful, exciting plot called Murder on the Orient Football Ground. And what happens is, in a needle match with Spurs, just when the whole Orient team is sweeping towards the Spurs goal, the referee, who's an Eskimo, just to add a touch of cunning to it, suddenly drops to the ground, dead. And they rush over thinking he'd swallowed the pee from his whistle. But no, he'd been strangled. Strangled? A referee in front of 30,000 people. So they call in Hercule Bon. And he says, it is quite simple how he was strangled. What happened was, and this is as far as I got. I mean, how the devil could he be strangled? I mean, strangle a referee in the middle of a football match in front of 30,000 people who didn't see a thing. So I gave it up. The fact is that my métier is not writing profitable, exciting stories about some superhero, but just to drivel on in these little stories on this program. As the old English saying has it, my word is my bond.
I'm not so sure you made my flesh creep there a couple of times. Dennis, Your phrase, an American in Paris.
It really was an intriguing situation. Despite the passage of the years, I could still recognize every one of my former classmates except her. That provocative figure across the room. Again, my eyes strayed to her, tall, willowy, with a touch of mischief in her eyes as she surveyed the other guests at this reunion. Because that's what this occasion was, a reunion of Class 5, who back in the 1940s had been what you might call the A-team at Craven Mount School. Obviously, all of us had only been in our teens then, but as I looked round at my former classmates, my former school friends, it was good to see that some of them, time had touched but lightly. Others, of course, it had bashed the daylights out of, but that lady in the corner there, the plump one who looked like she got her dresses from the same place as Boy George, could that really be Penelope Willifield? Sexy Penny, whose front room every red-blooded form fiver used to refer to as the OK Corral. But yes, yes, it was her. Or she, as Mr. Murchison, our English teacher, would have preferred us to say. Dear old Mr. Murchison, the only teacher in the school who made us go to the loo in alphabetical order. We'd already reminisced about him as we had about Edgar Barwick, the prefect who'd had his name taken off the school honours board for sending in a forged record request to family favourites. What else had we nattered about? Well, naturally, about what we'd been doing over that great gulf of years. Ginger Conroy, for example, the lad who'd found geometry so difficult he never did manage to work out how to calculate the shortest distance between two points. He'd become a taxi driver. Arthur Holroyd, whose twin passions in life had been scripture and model planes, he'd failed in his attempt to start a Salvation Air Force. While Freddie Mitchell, who'd always talked about becoming an astrologer when he left school, he gave up the idea because all his predictions had worked out so wildly inaccurate. What did you go in for? I said to him. Oh, he said, I became an economist. But fascinating as it was to discover the turns that their lives had taken, my thoughts kept returning to that coolly provocative woman across the room. Could she have been one of Form 5's more unattainable temptresses? Irene Livermore, perhaps, a girl so emotional that when the maths master told her that parallel lines never meet, she cried for 3 days. Or was she Sylvia Pacefoot, who'd got so neurotic that night I snagged her Angora sweater with my hangnail? Or might she even be Alice Tozer, who on the one occasion she allowed me to take her out, had come with me to a Chinese restaurant and ordered the whole of page 2. But no, all of those I'd already greeted and spoken to. Irene now had a husband who ran a small factory making eyeballs for merry-go-round horses. Sylvia had a job as a paid informer. She worked behind the information desk at Selfridges. While Alice had settled down in the country and was now breeding Celiums. She'd married a man called Simon Celium. Then I suddenly became conscious that my mystery lady was now eyeing me, and her smile could only be described as inviting. So naturally, I went across to her, and on reaching her side, I heard her murmur, "You still got that Donald Duck nightlight?" Well, that took me so aback, all I could do was nod mutely. "You don't remember me, do you?" she said. I said, "Frankly, no, and I can't think why I don't. I don't understand it." "Well, what is your name?" "Murray," she said. "Anna. Remember now?" I shook my head. I said, you must have changed more than anybody here." "That may well be true," she said. I said, "You know, I can't remember any Anna Murray." "Well," she said, "that's probably because you knew me then as Edward Murray." You see, That's the trouble with reunions. It's not just that old friends change. It's often as not, they change in ways you really could not anticipate. Which is why, as my blushes indicated, not only can an Alice Livermore arouse pity and Ginger Conroy provoke derision, but to paraphrase that Gene Kelly film, Anna Murray can embarrass.
Get it, Frank? couldn't spot that one. Caught us all out, I think, that time. Well done, Dennis. And while you were indulging in that touching reminiscence, our race judges have confirmed that today's winners by two short syllables are Dillis and Frank. And before I dash off to lead them into the winner's enclosure, I have time just to say goodbye.